Susan Sontag is an original observer of popular culture, bizarre creatures, pornography, happenings, and always politics, opera, ballet, and literature. She's very shrewd and witty in defining the crash of contemporary life. That's how my guest Susan Sontag was once described by writer Elizabeth Hardwick. 12 years ago, Sontag was diagnosed as having breast cancer. She underwent chemotherapy and several operations. Her sickness led her to think about the punitive and sentimental images that we use to describe sick people and their illnesses. Her observations led to her book Illness as Metaphor. She described how in the 19th century, tuberculosis was seen as a disease apt to strike the sensitive, the talented, and the passionate, whereas now, cancer is stereotyped as a disease which afflicts the psychically defeated, the inexpressive, and the repressed. Thinking about cancer this way, she says, stigmatizes anyone who has the disease and makes their experience of illness even worse than it might otherwise be. She applies the same kind of analysis to AIDS in her new book, AIDS and Its Metaphors. Susan Sontag told me why she's still interested in analyzing the images we use to discuss illness.
The metaphors are just ways of tracking attitudes. So what interests me, in fact, isn't, in this instance, verbal. I'm not that kind of linguistic purist. I'm not trying to make people clean up their language out of some idea of how language ought to be. What interests me is that metaphors and turns of speech are carriers of very deep attitudes, and it's the attitudes that matter. And a lot of the attitudes, I think, are wrong, false, misleading, and punishing, particularly to patients.
Let's get to one of the words that you really don't like, which has been used to describe the AIDS epidemic, and that's the word plague.
It took me 1 year to write this 100 pages. That's not because I wrote, as it were, 10 pages a month. I actually wrote the first draft within a month or two, and then I rewrote it about 10 or 12 times. And in the process of writing and rewriting, which is the way it works with essays, although fiction for me goes through many fewer revisions, I found that I was changing, and many of the attitudes and ideas that are expressed in the book are discoveries to me that I made around the sixth draft or the tenth draft or whatever. When I conceived of this as a very brief epilogue, not as a separate book, which I then, by its very title, wanted to hook onto the previous book, my title for the epilogue was In Time of Plague. Just to tell you that I myself thought that to call AIDS a plague was an interesting and effective and suggestive way of thinking about it. I was not critical of it, and it's somewhere around the sixth draft, when I already knew, of course, it was going to be a separate book, and so I had this kind of title in mind that would use the word metaphor, so it would remind people of the other book. But I saw some sentence in my draft, and where I, you know, like other plagues or like other diseases regarded as plagues, I think I would have said it that way, when I thought, no, wait a minute, is this a plague? What? I suddenly realized that plague was a metaphor. In other words, it was this discovery that I myself made. Now, why am I against it? I'm against it, first of all, because it's not true. A plague can only be a disease in which a very large number of people are going to fall ill and die. And we're talking, when I say a very large number, we're talking about a quarter or a third of the population, as was the case with the disease, the bubonic plague, from which we, you know, usually draw all our comparisons in the 14th century in Europe. It does carry all sorts of associations of punishment. It's hard to say plague without imagining that some people are being punished. In fact, it's hard to have a serious illness without feeling you're being punished. I mean, this is a basic human attitude. If you want to lift from people the sense that they're being punished, you have to work very hard. It's a basic kind of irrational reaction. But I don't think it should be reinforced by the kind of words that people use. And after all, it's only some words that, it's only some illnesses that are called plagues. The most obvious example is the influenza epidemic in 1918-1919. In which 20 million people died worldwide in the course of 15 months. More people actually than died in the First World War. Almost 1 million people died in this country. It was never called a plague.
I wonder, though, a lot of people have been using the word plague because that's the way they feel about the disease, that it feels like something we thought we'd never have to face. Plague has this kind of Middle Ages ring to it because of the bubonic plague, which you referred to. And I think a lot of people feel we thought we were through with this kind of illness. We thought we were immune to something that was life-threatening without any vaccine, without any cure, that would wipe out so many people, that we could see so many people we knew die without there even being a war to blame for it. And plague seems to sometimes have some of the mysteries and some of the sense of past that we associate with it. So I wonder if you think that where the word comes from affects whether it's a good or bad word. In other words, if people are using the word plague because it's the way they feel about it, if that's any different than if it was like other people using the word plague in describing a group that they weren't a part of.
Well, I think several things. I mean, what you say is absolutely right. But I think it has a lot to do with the fact that the disease is perceived, one, as repulsive, as deforming of the person. And also that it afflicts people, has afflicted people so far in this part of the world, who are thought of as marginal or pariah groups, namely, I mean, people in special categories, so-called risk groups. I mean, obviously, the first and most visible people with AIDS were homosexual and bisexual men. Then it cropped up among intravenous drug users, their consorts, and children, most of whom are black and Hispanic and very poor. Then there was another subgroup, hemophiliacs, let's say many of whom probably were middle class, but certainly they were a marginal group, et cetera, et cetera. Whenever an illness afflicts a particular group, I think it is perceived as having some kind of intention behind it.
My guest is Susan Sontag, and we're talking about her new book, AIDS and Its Metaphors. It's a sequel to her previous book, Illness as Metaphor. You wrote Illness as Metaphor after you had cancer.
When I had cancer.
When you had cancer. What about the language that was used around you by your doctors, perhaps, started to make you really conscious of the language that we use to describe illness and people who are sick?
Well, I became a cancer patient in the late 70s, and my cancer was diagnosed as terminal, so I not only found out, to my surprise, I had cancer, I found out that I was going to die, which, as it turned out, I didn't. And the discovery was not even so much the language the doctors used, although I quickly became aware of that, too. It was when I started to live mainly in hospitals and I discovered how ashamed people with cancer were of the illness, how they concealed it from their employers and friends and family members. And it wasn't just an illness. It seemed to be some kind of embarrassment or scandal. And so that was indeed the origin of that book, which I thought was the last book I would ever write. But I did get very good treatment and I was cured.
Did the doctors use language that you thought ended up victimizing you in some way or that you were uncomfortable with?
No, I don't. It really came... the doctors viewed me as odd, first of all, because I was asking for more treatment when they didn't want to give me a lot of treatment because they thought I was terminal, and also because I wanted to learn about the illness because I'm a naturally curious person. And they said, we've never seen somebody who was so interested. And I said, why shouldn't I be interested? I mean, as my life is on the line. And, well, usually people don't want to know about their treatment or about the illness. And I think that people are more curious about, let's say, diabetes or MS or heart or cardiac illness than they are about. They were really spooked by cancer. It's less true now, but it certainly was true 10 years ago when I was sick.
Why do you think it's less true now?
Well, for one thing, we have a more terrifying disease, a disease which is, I say in my new book that it seems as if our society or our kind of society needs a disease which is demonized. And then by extension, there is an imputation of fault or guilt to the patient. But although we need to do this with illnesses, make them symbolic or metaphoric and moralize about them, it's make them into a scandal. We perhaps only have place for one illness at a time, and that certainly was for generations cancer. And now I think it is AIDS. I think AIDS has become the great symbolic illness of our time, to which all sorts of interesting attitudes are attached, including our very attitudes toward the future and toward disaster and toward behavior of all kinds, which is why I thought it was worth writing another essay about, another small book about attitudes toward illness, because about AIDS as such, I don't think I have anything so original to say. It's a terrible disease. I've lost many friends to it. I think people should get good treatment. I think there is better treatment than most people are getting, et cetera, et cetera. I think there should be lots more money for research. Those are, I have the standard, I think, correct attitudes that many other people have. The contribution that I can make in my book is to explore all the attitudes associated with this illness. Concerns about pollution, for instance, and contamination that reinforce the horror of the disease. The disease is bad enough. Any serious illness that's life-threatening is bad enough. But why should people feel guilty? Why should they feel as if they are carriers of evil? And they do. And they do with AIDS, and they have with cancer.
What language do you use to describe the fact that you don't have cancer anymore? And what I mean is, some people say, I triumphed over cancer. I fought the battle and won. You really hate military metaphors when it comes to disease, and that's something you point out in illness as metaphor and AIDS and its metaphors. So when you, if someone asks you about your condition and you say that you no longer have cancer, what words do you use?
Well, I say I was cured because I struggled with the help of friends to get into a very high-powered, advanced medical situation where I was in an experimental, I was a guinea pig for some new drugs, which subsequently, of course, have been adopted, but they were still in an experimental stage. And I'm not averse to saying, I'm too modest, perhaps, in my language to want to say I triumphed about anything. That's not a word that comes easily to mind. To me, say I triumph. I tend to say, well, I did okay. But I would say I fought for my life. I don't say I fought the disease because that sounds corny. But I would say I really wanted to live. I really wanted to live. I was in no way an accomplice of this disaster. I didn't say, there's a part of me that doesn't want to live, and I wanted to do everything I could. I struggled. I don't think, you see, metaphors of struggle are wrong, because I think life is in part a struggle. I'm not against metaphoric language as such. I think when diseases become invading forces representing the alien other and the whole society mobilizes to fight the invader, when, for instance, as you can see in one associated example, mischievous or malicious tampering with computers is now described as a viral invasion, and it could very well have been another metaphor. I've been told by computer experts, which I'm certainly not, that some years ago it wasn't a virus in your computer, it was a worm, interestingly enough, and now it's become a virus. So it's when these become big collective metaphors that I think they are possibly the bearers of attitudes that ought to be examined and are punishing. But personally, of course, I have no difficulty in saying, yes, I fought for my life. I did.
One difference that you point out in the way our society is dealing with AIDS compared to the way we've dealt with cancer is that there's been a lot of psychologizing with cancer, that somebody's like pent-up anxiety helped them get the cancer,
or
led them to the cancer, or inability to express emotion.
Right.
And you say that we don't have that, an equivalent of that with AIDS, which you're pleased about, that it's not seen as a psychological expression.
Do you know, Terry, that since the book was published, two people have gotten in touch with me. I've had a lot of response to it, of course, to say that I'm wrong.
Really?
One of them is an AIDS patient, someone with AIDS, who say that there are now psychotherapists who are working with AIDS patients. I think this is absolute baloney. I want to say that very strongly. Who are telling AIDS patients that it's only if you don't really love life and have become depressed that you are infected by the virus, and that if you mobilize your positive feelings and your positive forces, you can repel the virus. So I guess there is no end to quackery and the kind of charlatans that arise in any situation. But it turns out there are some people out there who are trying to psychologize the AIDS situation. I didn't know that when I wrote the book.
Well, some doctors think that there is a connection between health and immunity and your psychological condition, that when you're more depressed, you're more vulnerable.
I think it's probably true, but I don't think it's decisive. And of course, I think people, I think a positive attitude is always helpful in if you're ill. But I don't think that the absence of a positive attitude is what makes you get ill. That's, I mean, that doesn't make the difference.
You think it results in a blame the victim attitude?
Yes. I think it makes people responsible for their illnesses in a way that, in effect, makes them feel guilty and embarrassed.
There is this sense of guilt with some disease, like with AIDS especially. We hear a hemophiliac who gets AIDS is considered an innocent person,
right,
who got AIDS, and that means that other people who get it are
or
guilty.
Or the babies are innocent. Yeah, I think it's terrible to use the language of innocence and guilt with illness. I mean, even though I have to say I find it very hard to identify with heartless promiscuity or drug abuse. I mean, these are not forms of behavior that I find attractive or that I would recommend to anyone. Or if I had a friend who was engaged in these activities, all questions of illness apart, I would probably try to encourage the friend to change his or her conduct. I mean, so I'm not saying that I don't judge people's behavior. I do. But on the other hand, I don't think anyone deserves to be ill or that illness should ever be regarded as an appropriate consequence of behavior, which I still might not particularly feel sympathetic to. That's the point I want to make.
You say in your new book that you realize a lot of people after having cancer would write a memoir to discuss it, but that seemed like a really inappropriate form to you. To you, you thought it would be more productive to have an idea to express in an essay.
Well, first of all, I did write illness as metaphor when I was still sick, when I was still in treatment, and it was not clear that I was going to survive. I did, in fact, think it might very well be my last book. In fact, according to my doctors, it was definitely going to be my last book, because I was told when my cancer was diagnosed that I had only a 10% chance to live as long as 2 years, which meant a 90% chance to die before that. And my son was told that I had 6 months. So I wasn't, you know, if it were after, who knows, I may very well turn this into, you know, my illness experience into fiction. I'm kind of slow and takes me maybe years and years to digest something. I just wrote a memoir about when I was 14 years old. So it's taken me all this time to be able to put that into language. At the time, while this was a breaking story, to say the least, the best I could do was, and I thought it was something, it was a contribution, was to share some ideas that I had. It isn't that I thought it was inappropriate, is what I'm trying to say. It's just that I couldn't do it. I was too close. I was then really too close. I have nothing against autobiographical writing. On the contrary, I'm doing an awful lot of it now. But at that time, I wanted, in a way, the distance or the feeling of mastery that would come from understanding something and feeling that I could be useful to other people. I didn't want to just tell people how I was suffering and crying and loving friends and relatives were taking care of me. I wanted to help fellow patients.
A lot of people who have faced life-threatening illness and survive talk about how it really changed their lives, how their priorities changed, the way they spend their time changed. Did anything like that happen to you?
Absolutely. Oh, sure. It's absolutely a turning point in my life. I think it was actually a positive experience. It may sound strange to say it. There are a lot of things I didn't like about it, like scaring people who love me, particularly my son, who went into a sort of deep despair when he thought that I was going to die. And that was certainly a wound in his life. And I didn't like, you know, being cut up and mutilated in operations. And I didn't like a lot of other things. And yet, I think it was a positive experience. I think it was a deepening experience. It's put me more in contact with myself, and I don't think it didn't make me into a different person, but it released things that were inhibited, I have more access to my own gift for intimacy, if I can put it in such an indirect and shy form. I find it easier and more necessary to express feeling for other people. I mean, I had those feelings, but I was more inhibited before. And when I was very ill, in the years I was very ill, I mostly spent that time holding hands, as it were. People gathered around me. They were wonderful. Number of people came through for me in the most magnificent way, and I felt that holding hands and being with people and laughing and crying together was a tremendous, exalting experience. I had just euphoric moments in this period of being ill, and people who were with me felt that too. I mean,
So you've kept that intimacy.
I have to some extent, right?
Why was it something that you didn't have before? Was it a time thing, or did you think that it was too sentimental to express intimacy that way?
I think I had a very emotionally very deprived childhood. I was left to myself when I was a child. My father died when I was 5, and I really never knew him. And my mother was away most of my childhood. So I think I had a little bit still a bit the psychology of an orphan. And so I would be afraid of showing feeling because of being afraid of rejection. It's something so deep, you know, and so primal. You know it's not true, but somewhere deep down you just don't feel that people are going to love you, because if you didn't feel loved when you were 2 or 3 years old, it's very hard to come to that later on. It's a kind of acquired confidence. I mean, I see my son, for instance, who knows himself to have been much loved when he was a small child. He's now an adult. He just has a different way of relating to people. I mean, because there's some basic confidence that you have when you feel that you're loved when you're a very tiny child that you can't have. Or anyway, you have to do a lot of work to acquire it. And I had to do a lot of work. I'm in my 50s now, and I think I'm just beginning, and partly due to my illness experience, to get over the wounds of that sort of feeling of being an orphan or being an abandoned or rejected child.
You're very grateful about the feelings that were expressed towards you by friends when you were sick. You told us that you have had a lot of friends who have died of AIDS. When you see a friend who is dying or who has AIDS, does it affect the way you relate to them, knowing what it's like to have something that's considered to be a terminal illness?
It not only affects the way I relate to people that I meet with AIDS, it affects the way I relate to anybody who has a serious illness. I've gone through cancer experiences with a lot of people, and people who know that I feel this way approach me. I mean, people approach me sometimes in the street or the intermission at the theater or in an airport, and I've had this experience of somebody coming up and saying, illness as metaphor meant a lot to me, and I know immediately what that means, and maybe we go off and have coffee and talk. I feel I can. Another thing that changed is, I think I was a normally compassionate person before, but I feel an enormous empathy and identification with people who are ill, and I feel the capacity to connect with them. I mean, I'm actually interested. If they want to tell me long stories about their operations or their tumors, I don't get bored. In fact, I get quite caught up in it. I think it's, I get pleasure and strength out of being there for people who are ill. It's something that I need to do, even. It makes me feel good.
You're really one of the few people who has managed to survive as an essayist and intellectual without an institutional base, without a teaching position or a full-time editing position or something like that.
Right.
It's a good trick to pull that off.
It's basically impossible. I know, and in a way I'm... I don't know how I do it. Well, it's almost impossible. First of all, you have to accept a modest standard of living.
Well, related to that, I read somewhere that when you had cancer, you didn't have health insurance.
That's right.
And, you know, health insurance is in our country usually job-related, institutionally based.
It's because I didn't have a job, exactly.
Yeah, if you're freelance.
And I had never been sick before, which I suppose is one ingredient in the fact that I did survive. I was a healthy person to begin with.
How did you get around that without having health insurance?
I never was sick.
I mean, once you got cancer.
Oh, I'm in some stupid... You mean, how now?
No, how then?
Oh, friends raised money for me.
Really?
No, I couldn't possibly have paid my bills. At that time, and this was in the late 70s, when my saga went over a period of about 3 years, from 76 to 79, my treatment and all the medically related costs of hospitalizations, 5 operations, 2.5 years of chemotherapy, et cetera, came to about $70,000. That probably today would be double or triple. Mm-hmm. And that money was raised for me. And of course, I'm incredibly grateful for that.
You have health insurance now?
I do. I'm in some stupid, very generic group plan, which, you know, doesn't require a physical examination. Exactly. Because I'm considered to be a poor risk, although I think I'm quite a healthy person. I have no reason to think I'm any less healthy now than I was before I had cancer. How do you survive? Well, I don't know. I just have I have a very old-fashioned idea of being a writer, and I love teaching. And I did teach when I was in my 20s, but I think that's a full-time job, and I don't want to, I want to be a full-time writer.